It's a Tuesday edition of the My Ag Life Daily News Report. Thanks for tuning in, everyone. I'm your host, Lori Boyer. Coming up in today's show, Taylor Charleston will have a report on using mulch for weed control in citrus orchards. I'll have a check-in of national and regional agricultural news, beginning with regional ag news right after this word from our sponsor.
There's giant potential sleeping in your soil. Under drought conditions, it's never been more important to wake it up. Phycoterra, a superior soil microbial food, activates the native microbes responsible for your soil's health and water-holding capacity. Adding Phycoterra to your crop increases water retention up to 10% and optimizes crop nutrient availability. Plus, it delivers excellent mixability and application flexibility, making it easy to add to your existing crop input strategy. Visit Phycoterra.com to learn how you can wake up your soil's giant potential with Phycoterra.
In regional agricultural news, higher education is something that every student should have access to, and a California Table Grape Commission has been helping make this a reality for many deserving students from key table grape growing regions since 1985. The industry organization recently awarded 9 scholarships to high-achieving students who are all set to begin college this fall. To qualify for a field worker scholarship, the applicant, parent, or guardian must work in a California table grape harvest, according to a press release. The commission awarded 3 field worker scholarships of $25,000 to each student attending four-year universities, as well as 3 $14,500 Bridgefield Worker Scholarships to students who will attend community college for 2 years before transferring to a four-year university. In addition, the California Table Grape Commission presented $25,000 agricultural scholarships to 3 students attending a four-year university and studying in an agricultural field. Sunkist has brought a new online machine that uses artificial intelligence to sort 12 pieces of citrus fruit per second per lane. It's called SunSort, and it uses Google AI technology to automatically identify fruit characteristics such as size, shape, weight, blemishes, and even the decay that might not be visible to the naked eye, according to a company press release. SunSort returns data to the operator, who decides where he or she wants to send the fruit, according to Jose Flores, software and electrical engineering manager at Sunkist Research and Technical Services, the research arm of the citrus giant. Bringing AI to the fruit sorting process allows pack houses to dramatically increase the speed, accuracy, and efficiency of their sorting operations, according to RTS General Manager Aaron Gorski. He says Sunset equipment can conduct a comprehensive fruit assessment and sort the piece accordingly all in one pass. This offers substantial operational efficiencies and improvements. The operator manages the sorter settings, which dictate which bin each piece of fruit will go to. These settings can be changed manually. This flexibility is important because the market changes. What might be first grade at the beginning of the season might not be first grade at the end, according to Flores. With SunSort, the fruit is running right into the boxes, and he says these go to a pallet without any human contact. SunSort has been in development for 3 years and has been rolled out in 5 Sunkist facilities in California over the past year. It is also being used in 4 facilities in Argentina and 5 in Spain, which are not owned by Sunkist. After its success in Sunkist packing houses, SunSort now is available to any processing facility that needs to increase revenues through fast and accurate sorting, according to the company. Driscoll's, the global market leader of fresh strawberries, blueberries, raspberries, and blackberries, and Berry Gardens Growers Limited, the UK's largest berry grower cooperative, formally agreed on the terms for the purchase of Berry Gardens Limited, the sales, packaging, and distribution entity of Berry Gardens Growers Limited. Berry Gardens has grown, distributed, and marketed Driscoll's varieties on an exclusive basis in the UK for more than 20 years. The sale of the commercial desk to Driscoll's is the latest development in a long-standing relationship between the two businesses. Sole Source Capital LLC, an industrial-focused private equity firm, has announced that its portfolio company, Worldwide Produce, one of the largest fresh produce and dairy distributors on the West Coast, has acquired Valley Food Services, a premier food service distributor of fresh produce and dairy serving the Coachella Valley market. The acquisition of Valley strengthens Worldwide Produce's presence in the Coachella Valley and marks the company's second acquisition in the past 3 months. It's also the fourth completed acquisition acquisition for Worldwide Produce since it became a sole source capital portfolio company in 2019. Terms of the transaction were not disclosed. Established in 2021 and headquartered in Banning, California, Valley Food Service sells primarily to the food service end market. The company offers a full suite of fresh produce and dairy products, including avocados, leaf lettuce, tomatoes, and citrus. And as I just mentioned, the International Fresh Produce Association's Food Service Conference is coming up July 28th through the 29th in Monterey, California. In addition to the excellent lineup of speakers, the Food Service Conference includes an expo that is open from 11 to 4:30 on July 29th. The expo features growers, shippers, and processors, transportation companies, technology providers, and those with packing solutions. The event will serve as a one-stop shop for the over 100 buyer companies in attendance. This year, buyers come from every segment of the food supply chain, including food service operators, food service distributors and wholesalers, K-12 representatives, chefs and menu developers, and more. Buyers attending food service in 2022 include Chick-fil-A, HelloFresh, U.S. Foods, Stanford University, and K-12 representatives from several school districts like Los Angeles Unified School District, Detroit Public Schools, Houston Independent School District, Seattle Public Schools, and more. The International Fresh Produce Association is the largest and most diverse international association serving the entire fresh produce and floral supply chain.
Do you know the nutrient use efficiency people? Yes, I'm talking about the folks at Verdesian Life Sciences that deliver crop insights and solutions so California crops grow to their full potential. From micros with a proprietary delivery system to solutions that help improve the uptake and assimilation of applied nutrients. Visit VLSCI.com to learn more about Verdesian solutions or to connect with a local representative right here in California.
Although the citrus season is not over, growers are always encouraged to think about what they'll be doing for their orchards next season. And one practice recommended by UCCE Subtropical Horticulture Advisor Sonia Rios, especially for new citrus orchards, is mulching. Mulching brings along a method of weed control that can be utilized in both conventional and organic orchards, and can potentially reduce the need for herbicides by physically blocking the sun from bare soil around the trees, thus preventing a new weed from sprouting and competing with young trees for resources.
Because the soil is open to sunlight, it helps reduce, helps weeds grow and complete their life cycles. Mulches are used to help manage weeds in some organic production systems. The mulch provides a physical barrier on the soil surface and must block nearly all light reaching the surface so that the weeds which emerge beneath the mulch do not have sufficient light to survive. Mulch can also be very beneficial to maintain water and soil moisture in the ground, keeps temperatures down in the summer and up during the winter, keeps the moisture in, and ideal for beneficial bacteria. Other benefits include it increases root growth, as it breaks down, it adds nutrients back into the soil. But let me just warn you about that one. You don't want to depend completely on your mulch for this type of nutrient management. You really need a nutrient management set in place. This just helps. It's like a little bonus on top of your nutrient management plan that you do have. It also increases earthworm activity, which is really good for the shallow root systems of most of the tree crops and of course, the feeder roots and citrus, and can be used for both organic and conventional groves.
Like many practices that provide multiple benefits, mulching also comes with its challenges. There's a right way and a wrong way to apply it in citrus orchards, according to Rios, and applying it the wrong way can help to promote detrimental disease, which could be economically devastating to a young orchard.
You do not want to stack the mulch up against the citrus tree base or the trunk. You usually apply it around the drip line. To the picture to the right, you can kind of see where the drip line is, the canopy area. How width of the tree. If this is not done correctly and it does start touching, it can cause a root rot, which encourages pests and instigates certain citrus tree diseases, which you do not want. The most common one, which I see on a daily basis when people do try to use mulch as a weed suppressant, is Phytophthora. Phytophthora can cause a slow decline of the tree, especially in new plantings. The leaves turn yellow and it's a very slow death. It can be as quick as a few weeks to a few years, and even the tree can live up to it. How I like to see Phytophthora is kind of like equivalent to a staph infection for people. You know how staph is all over the place, no matter where we're at. However, if you're in the hospital, if you're weak, if you're tired, you become more susceptible to it. And if you get a cut of some type, then guess what? You're gonna be more susceptible to the staph infection. That's kind of like Phytophthora. Phytophthora is all over the place. And whether the roots get nipped because of gophers, or they get dug up by coyotes, or you use a dirty shovel, or whatever the case is, if you damage any types of roots or it becomes weak because you water too much or water too little, then your tree can actually get sick from this. What it does is it basically destroys the feeder roots of susceptible rootstocks, and then the pathogen infects the root cortex, which turns soft and then starts to separate and gets really mushy. If the destruction of the feeder roots occurs faster than they will, faster than they can regenerate, the uptake of water and nutrients will be severely limited. The tree will grow poorly, store energy reserves will be depleted, and production will decline. The most tolerant rootstocks are trifoliate orange, swingles, citronello, centrange, calimo, and sour orange, which is probably the most popular and which probably what most of the trees sit on today.
Disease-related challenges of mulch might sound scary, but as Ria's mentioned, correct application of the mulch will prevent this from occurring. In total, mulching is highly recommended in young citrus orchards, especially in Southern California growing regions. For My Ag Life, I'm Taylor Chalstrom.
Sponsored by the California Walnut Board and Commission, delivering value to growers and handlers with advocacy, research programs, and walnut promotions. Doing more together.
In national agricultural news, Russia, China, North Korea, and Iran would be banned from owning U.S. agricultural land under legislation just advanced by a House panel. It was the second try for House appropriators after they failed last year to get the Senate to agree to a ban on foreign ownership of U.S. ag land for the key U.S. foes in the annual USDA spending bill. But this year, Washington State Representative Dan Newhouse suggested war and aggression could make a difference.
Given the horrific events in Ukraine at the hands of Russia and the Putin regime. As many members of this committee know, China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea are not our allies.
Current federal law imposes no restrictions on foreign farmland ownership here, requiring reporting only, while just six states impose bans that Newhouse says can get circumvented. He says the issue is too important to drop.
This is about our country's national security, in ensuring that adversaries like China, like Russia, like North Korea, or Iran do not gain a foothold on American soil.
USDA reports China, Russia, and Iran accounted for a combined 200,000 acres of foreign-owned ag land in 2019, or less than 0.7%. China accounted for nearly all of it.
People's Republic of China is only interested in reaping every possible benefit from U.S. land without giving back or considering our future to sustain an independent energy and food production. The U.S. cannot become dependent on our adversaries for our domestic food supply.
But 60% of China's foreign ownership came from its purchase of U.S. pork giant Smithfield Food. In the meantime, allies Canada, the Netherlands, Italy, and Germany held the lion's share of foreign-owned U.S. ag land, just over 35 million acres in 2019, or just under 3% of such privately held land. U.S. Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm recently expressed interest in possibly lifting smog-fighting gasoline rules to help fight high gas prices at the nation's pumps. The secretary also backed off a plan to ban fuel exports during a wide-ranging meeting with refiners. Reuters News says tensions are high between President Biden and oil refiners. The two sides departed from a recent meeting far apart on possible solutions. Industry sources familiar with the meeting say both sides will continue talking. Biden has recently been critical of oil industry CEOs for pulling in huge profits from a supply crunch made worse by Russia's invading Ukraine. The White House is unhappy with the refining industry's moves to idle about 1 million barrels per day of production capacity since 2020. Administration officials say the companies need to use those profits to restart plants and help to fill the supply gap. Refiners say investing in reopening plants carries significant financial risks. The House and Senate each passed the Keep Kids Fed Act last week, but the bill had to return to the House because the Senate version was slightly different. The Hagsden Report says the House passed the Senate's version of the bill that requires a reestablishment of the record price category that Rand Paul of Kentucky insisted on, including in the Senate version. The agreement between the leaders of each committee in charge of school meals originally merged the reduced price and free meal categories into one free meal category for the upcoming school year. The legislation also provides $3 billion in additional funding for the school meals program, with offsets coming from recessions from the Ag Department and the Small Business Administration programs. Senate Ag Committee Chair Debbie Stabenow says schools and parents can rest easy knowing that help is on the way so kids can continue getting school and summer meals. The U.S. Department of Commerce determined late last week that urea ammonium nitrate solutions from Russia are being sold in the U.S. at less than fair value. The U.S. International Trade Commission will now make the final determination as to whether the domestic industry in the U.S. has been injured and if countervailing tariffs will be applied. While there is some debate on the effects these tariffs have on skyrocketing fertilizer prices, some agricultural groups are concerned that this ruling could be another blow to farmers facing increasing input prices. The estimated weighted average dumping margins recommended by the Department of Commerce for Russian producers of UAN are 8.16% to 122.93%. At least four Russian fertilizer companies face these tariffs. If the ITC determines that material injury exists, the Department of Commerce will issue an anti-dumping duty order to assess anti-dumping duties on Russian UAN imports. If the ITC determines that injury does not exist, the proceeding will be terminated. The ITC voted in August of 2021 to continue its investigation into UAN solutions imports from Russia and Trinidad and Tobago. The claim was that these imports are allegedly subsidizing and sold into the U.S. at less than fair value. In February of 2022, the Department of Commerce published its preliminary determination in the case. This came after an investigation that took place from April 1st of 2020 to March 31st of 2021. The most recent fertilizer trade dispute comes after the ITC ruled in March of 2021 to impose 19% tariffs on phosphate fertilizer from Morocco. The ruling imposed tariffs for 5 years. What should a producer know about keeping records and documents in the event of a natural disaster, as well as what documentation should they obtain if a disaster affects their operation? USDA Ag News reporter Rod Bain has more information.
Farmers and ranchers across the land have dealt with various natural disasters of late, floods, fires, and drought, for example. What should they do to begin the process to access USDA disaster programs? Farm Service Agency Deputy Administrator Scott Marlowe says it starts with
folks in touch with their FSA office. We have a whole series of programs that folks can get access to.
Yet getting access to these programs involves producers having proper documentation.
They document damage. They document what's going on. They take documentation of everything that's happened in the disaster.
Documents coming in the form of notes of conversations with local FSA staff members on disaster programs and required documentation, as well as taking pictures of damages. Just as important is putting documents vital to the operation on a flash drive well before a disaster occurs to have access to at the time of an emergency. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
U.S. honey production has dropped by 1.4% per year during the past three decades, while honey imports have grown by 7.6% every year, so imports have been filling the domestic supply deficit. Imports have exceeded domestic honey production since 2005 and accounted for 74% of U.S. honey supplies in 2021. The top three foreign suppliers are India, Vietnam, and Argentina, and together they supply more than 71% of the total imports. Honey imports grew as domestic consumption of honey and honey sweetened products increased. The expansion reached an all-time high last year when domestic production was at its lowest volume since 1991. During 2021, production in all three of the major honey-producing states, including North Dakota, South Dakota, and California, were 25% below 1991 levels, while production in the rest of the U.S. declined by almost half during the same period. Shrinking market production was mainly due to decreased honey production per colony.
Unsure of your naval orange worm program? No worries now with Rango, a proven solution to protect your orchard at hull split from naval orange worm. Rango is an OMRI-listed broad-spectrum biopesticide with no known resistance, making it an excellent rotation and tank mix partner for both conventional and organic growers. Partner with Rango today. Contact your PCA, local dealer, or visit rangonow.com. Rango, no worries now.
Eric Middleton bills himself as a full-time entomologist, part-time ninja warrior. He recently joined UC Cooperative Extension as the Integrated Pest Management Advisor for San Diego, Los Angeles, and Orange Counties. Growing up in Utah, he said he developed his love for bugs. And Middleton carried that insect appreciation into his college studies and even into his pastime, which is competing on the American Ninja Warrior Obstacle Challenge.
I really started getting interested in insects when I was young. So growing up, my mom was a geologist. We grew up in Utah. And what that meant is that we spent a lot of time out in the field looking at rocks. And I wasn't particularly interested in rocks. So I went looking for other things that were of more interest to me. And there were bugs everywhere. So all this time I spent outdoors, I really started to get interested in bugs. I thought they were really neat, really fascinating. And then when I went to college and then later on to graduate school, I decided that I wanted to study insects and try to learn more about them. And then also I started getting interested in agricultural production because I didn't only just want to study insects, but I also wanted my research and the stuff that I was doing to actually be useful for people and be applicable to people. And agriculture was something that always interested me as well. Food production was something that I thought was really important. And insects are very, very important for that. So for me, it was really just kind of something that I started out in childhood and then turned into, I want to do something meaningful with my life. Look, this is great. I'm already interested in bugs. Now we can see how they're affecting food production and agricultural production.
At the University of Minnesota, Middleton conducted his PhD research looking at wildflower plantings along the edges of farm fields. The goal was to see their impact on pollinators as well as beneficial predatory insects. Although pollinators have grabbed the public's attention, Middleton said predators should be right up there in the limelight.
When I was at the University of Minnesota, I was looking at these wildflower plantings put on the edge of commercial fields. And they had put them in originally for pollinators. And as you said, those get a lot of attention and they are important. But one thing that people aren't usually as aware of, and certainly the public isn't as well aware of, is how important beneficial insects, different insect predators or other things that aren't insects, things like spiders, which are also predators, and different parasitoids can be, because they can control and are very important for controlling other damaging pests that can harm agricultural production. So really, they are extremely important and deserve just as much attention as pollinators have been getting, and debatably even more so. So there's lots of different cases where if you have the habitat or the necessary resources that are there so you can keep predators or other parasitoids in your system, they can oftentimes, at the very least, reduce the number of times that you'll need to apply insecticides or other pesticides to your crops, and in some cases can remove the need entirely. So overall, they're extremely economically important for people, but unfortunately not very well known. So that's something that I want to make more clear with my research, and we found some really interesting results with that.
But pollinator habitat is not a one-size-fits-all type of system. Middleton said different types of plantings work better in different situations. One of the things he hopes to do is determine how they can be integrated into the agricultural systems in the south part of the state.
It really depends on the context and on the situation. Having different things like hedgerows or preserving other native habitat, it really is context dependent. In some cases, it can work really well. In other cases, it's not the most feasible. But in a lot of different cases, you can have them in places where you might not expect them. What I was studying was wildflower plantings that were put on the edge of these fields in sort of unused land. But you can also be growing strips of wildflowers in the row middles of things like, say, orchard crops. Different things like maybe citrus or in some cases avocado. So you can have different sources of resources, of habitat for these beneficial insects to use that can be put in a whole bunch of different places. And also just for me, I'm really interested and curious to learn more about what is being produced in San Diego and try to figure out what ways can we actually use these more integrated pest management techniques and really try to promote beneficial insects instead of just always having to resort to pesticides.
Despite the belief that Southern California is mostly urban areas, Middleton said quite the opposite is true, and agriculture is alive and living in the South State. Where he sees a difference is with the large number of small farms. While they're not as centralized, he said it still offers opportunities to work with a lot of different farmers, including organic farmers, growing a lot of different crops.
It's very different here, as you said, in San Diego County, Orange and Los Angeles. Yeah, there's a lot more sort of urban areas. But I think one of the things that's not particularly well known is that in San Diego County, there actually are pretty big agricultural areas. It's just that they're much more spread out. They're much more broken up. And they're not just sort of contiguous swaths of crops being grown. And that is a bit of a challenge because it means that it's harder to find these different places. It's hard to have a sort of more one-size-fits-all plan. But I think that's also really exciting because there are lots of small farmers. There are lots of people who are growing all kinds of different crops, commodities, lots of organic growers. And that means there's lots of different opportunities for different types of IPM to be utilized. And there's lots of different areas where innovation can occur. So the fact that there's so many people working on all these different little plots, sometimes with small budgets and working in these smaller spaces, means that there's a lot of different opportunities to explore what actually works best, not only for them, but then can be applied on a much broader scale. So I'm looking forward to it, but there definitely are challenges because things are a lot more decentralized. And there's also losses a lot of different crops, which means you have to be very knowledgeable about a whole lot of different things in order to understand how to best help people.
While in grad school in Minnesota, Middleton sought a way to balance the mental rigors of working on a PhD. He had seen American Ninja Warrior on TV, so he decided to give it a try. And the Bug Ninja, as he's called, has done quite well. Middleton credited his success in the competition partly to being motivated by insects. He's also used the platform to educate the public about bugs.
So American Ninja Warrior, it's a TV show. It's a competition TV show. And basically, it's a very difficult obstacle course that involves a lot of upper body obstacles where you're swinging on bars, throwing yourself from bar to bar up in the air, high above a pool. And it is a lot of fun. It's very intense. And it really is one of just basically one of the most difficult but also most fun obstacle courses in the world. So I started training for Ninja Warrior competitions back when I first started graduate school. And the reason that I got involved with it was that when I moved to Minnesota to do my PhD, I knew that that was going to be something that would take up a lot of my time. It would be taking up a lot of my mental focus and energy. And I knew I needed something outside of school to do and to make sure that I had sort of had a balanced life. I had always been interested in American Ninja Warrior. I'd seen clips of the show and I've always thought it looked really fun. And a part of me thought, you know, I think I could do that. But I also knew that that's what a lot of people think when they watch it. And that's usually not correct when we think it's something, you know, is much easier than it looks. So I found a local gym that had some of the replicas of obstacles built there. I went there, I was pretty good at it. And then I happened to apply for the show. And my sort of thing that made me distinctive or stand out from other people when I was applying to the show was that I was an entomologist. So I was interested in bugs. And I was saying that I use bugs as my inspiration because bugs truly are the greatest athletes in the world. They're much stronger than us. They're much faster than us. And so those are my inspirations when I go and try to complete these obstacles. And I'm extremely fortunate. I've been able to compete on the show for the past 7 years now, and it's been a ton of fun.
Partway through the competition, Middleton made an agreement with the two show hosts that if he successfully completed the course, they had to eat a tempura fried tarantula. Yes, it kind of has an ick factor, but it also calls attention to insects as a good protein source for an ever-increasing population.
basically at the end of the course, there's a buzzer. You get to the very end and then you hit the buzzer, and that signifies that you've finished the course. Well, for me, I decided that I wanted to have a little bit, something a bit more interesting. The two hosts, Matt and Akbar, they're the ones who are sort of calling the runs and, you know, explaining them to the audience. I made a deal with them that if I made it to the end of the course and I hit the buzzer, that they had to eat a tempura fried tarantula spider. And the idea behind this was that it's kind of fun. It's kind of has an ick factor, but it also is talking about something that I think is very important, which is that I'm interested in food production. I'm interested in bugs. And one of these areas that people are looking more and more into now is eating insects, because they're really great sources of protein. They're really great sources of nutrients, and they can be grown and raised using a lot fewer resources than a lot of other types of animal protein. So I wanted to use this opportunity to make what I thought was a really good point, that people should be eating more insects. And this was a really good way to get that message out. And I was fortunate. I got through the course, hit the buzzer at the end, and Matt and Akbar had to eat that tempura fried tarantula spider, which is very fun to see. And actually, I think they enjoyed it more than they thought they would.
Middleton said he plans to continue competing on American Ninja Warrior for as long as he's able. You may be able to see him compete in the next few weeks in an upcoming show, which was filmed before he moved to San Diego.
I certainly hope to be back on the show. The season is still currently running, the one that I competed on. So one of the episodes I will be competing in the future will air probably in the next couple of weeks. So keep an eye out, and hopefully they'll give me some airtime. I have found some places to train. There's not quite as many as I had either in Minnesota or later on in Florida where I did my postdoc, but I'm definitely still going to be training and certainly would love to compete again.
This is Vicki Boyd reporting for My Ag Life.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcast, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
That will wrap up today's show. You've been listening to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Lori Boyer. From all of us here at the JCS Marketing team, thank you for listening.